Well, I thought that tonight I'll delay one more week the question of the anthropic principle, because the subject of mind and supermind has to have, I think, a final treatment, even though we've approached the transitional idea between mind and supermind a couple of times. I think we can focus a little bit more rigorously on the transition between the two. You noticed the title of that chapter, which I just didn't show you. Thought processes, the instruments of the supermind, / thought processes. Yeah, I'm about to go off into another world here. You better do it now.
I'd like to request more opinions. Tomorrow from 2:30 at the event pavilion is going to be a very, very important meeting where the process of choosing the new coordination group of Vladimir Dorville will begin. And it is entirely up to us, the resident assembly, to make these choices, to understand what they have done, what they haven't done. And they will self-evaluate.
You can tell that Don is a member of the Residence Assembly Service, which
is facilitating as much as it can whatever process.
Which assumes of some things about participation and lack thereof, and so it unfortunately puts itself in a position of representing. At the same time that it's trying to facilitate a process that it should represent. And so that's always a kind of complex position to be in. On the one hand, it knows the importance and purpose of it, and on the other hand, we don't know the importance and purpose of it, although it's supposed to be us who's doing it. And so it's a contradictory sort of situation to be in, and I think we can warmly acknowledge the effort. And in order for us to understand that effort better, and also to understand the anthropic principle when we get to it, it's very important to let go of a lot of rational prejudices. Actually, the process should emanate from the center of our being. And that's... No, at the invitation of the RA service. It's a very difficult thing to, even what you just said, you know, we can't do anything, we don't make decisions. These are rational prejudices, prejudgments about what we are and what we're not, what we should be and what we shouldn't be, what you will accept that we are and what you won't accept that we are, what we would like to be in spite of ourselves. There are all kinds of rational shades of feeling and meaning and understanding regarding the selection of such an important group. The Lavanir d'Oroville, the future of Oroville, minds and souls who are responsible for visualizing and implementing something that is generally beyond human comprehension. Is it possible to understand a process like that, which is so fraught with lower human formations? Is it really possible to enter into a process like that from a universal consciousness? This course is called The Philosophy of Evolution, Mind and Supermind. And it's an attempt to understand what mind is, what its limits are, and what an evolution beyond it implies and entails. When we ended last week on this page, we had a formulation of what it implies. The evolution beyond mind implies a potentiality inherent in life that is not mind, but is greater than, that is to say, other than and superior to in its function and structure. And that the implication is that potential exists. And we heard an elaborate argument last time that Sri Aurobindo gives in this chapter about the necessity of its existence. Not only is it hopeful and a spiritual ideal, but from the point of view of philosophy, according to Sri Aurobindo, it is a necessity of existence. The inherent potentiality of something greater than mind, towards which mind is evolving, is a necessity of existence. And I pointed out at the end of the at the end of the hour, that is not a theory that is accepted by scientists normally, although some do accept it. But it is a theory that is accepted by a significant segment of philosophers. Those who take it upon themselves to understand as well as humanly possible the meaning of existence. Those most people are called philosophers. And there aren't many really great ones, but throughout history there have been quite a substantial number of them, if we go sort of century by century. So we've surveyed the ideas of people like Aristotle and Henri Bergson and Alfred North Whitehead and Sri Aurobindo and a few others. Who would agree? John Locke would agree that something greater than mind is a necessity of existence for there to be something that exists. And that which is greater than mind is generally called spirit. Sri Aurobindo has introduced the idea that between mind and spirit itself, there are other planes and gradations of planes of consciousness. Mind is a subsidiary of the lower range of those planes and the top of an evolutionary scale which exists in time and space, visibly, tangibly, perceptibly, knowably. Mind is knowable, tangible, perceptible, as are life and body. But, he said, because of the extraordinarily purposive nature of consciousness in all of its infinite diversity of manifestations in matter and life and mind throughout history over 3 billion years, because of that amazing diversity and purposiveness, it is necessary to conclude that there is an intelligence, capital I, to give it an inadequate name, the Logos, that organizes its own manifestation in all of these planes through time and space. Mind couldn't do that. Mind can't know that. We know mind well enough to know that it cannot conceive of this mechanism that it itself is. It merely acknowledges that it is what it is. And I didn't mention Heidegger in that list a while ago, but he is one of those extraordinary philosophers who, in the last 20 years of his life or so, after 40 years of rigorous, perhaps the most rigorous philosophical effort ever made, entered into a state of radiant, let's say, consciousness of the radiance of being, and could at the same time reflect critically on our current state. And so he wrote some books about what technology is doing to the human being and to language, and how it is doing it and why it is doing it and what it could mean, either positively or negatively. His commentary on the question of technology in the 50s and 60s is extraordinary. And he has influenced thinking about the nature of existence in ways that we can't conceive.
This is Heidegger.
Heidegger. So I was just looking at Abraham Maslow's work in the last few days, and he wrote a couple of books titled Toward a Psychology of Being, and The Higher Reaches of Human Nature, or something like that. A psychology in the 60s, and when a lot of psychologists were consuming LSD, and not for the sake of riotous bacchic pleasure, but for the sake of altering consciousness in order to perceive aspects of reality that the mind doesn't get, doesn't see. Heidegger is the one who announced in the 50s that being the being of all of these beings is the real nature of the human consciousness. And knowing that being of things is the true way of knowing. Not knowing the details in the rational way that the mind prefers, but knowing being itself as a radiant essence of everything. After decades of rigorous philosophical thought, he came to this understanding, and that language, poetic language, is the vehicle for the expression of that consciousness. So what Bergson and Whitehead and Heidegger and Sri Aurobindo were saying often overlaps in very interesting ways. Heidegger did not have the concept of the evolution of consciousness. Whitehead and Bergson did, and especially Bergson. So what's implied by this concept of evolution beyond mind is the necessity of this essential nature of reality, which is other than mind, but which works similarly to mind in that it knows and does everything spontaneously from itself, because it is the being of things. Things will never be the being of things. Things are temporal. Things are temporal expressions of their being. So there's a lot of philosophy that grew out of Heidegger's thinking. People like Marcuse and the critical theory people and all the phenomenologists and so on understood that what we know is a temporal, partial expression of what we are, or what something is. So you are much more than what you are manifesting right now in this room, and in the whole arc of your life, what you have to realize and manifest can't be measured in time, in terms of time and space and tangible things. You are much more than any of the moments that you can gather together as an impression of who you are. Even you, knowing everything that you are much more than those moments that you can gather. Certainly much more than I can gather from any number of moments of your life that I experience. And so if we put all of that together and we think about life in general on the earth and how some things have actually become other things through evolution. Some potentialities were not fulfilled by the species in which they manifested at some point, and they were more fulfilled in another species that grew out of that species. And so we can look horizontally at many species that seem to be working out or expressing similar principles in very different but similar ways. And we can know them genetically as being very closely related, and we can know them phenotypically as being extraordinarily different, and yet we can know that the principles that their lives manifest are the same. Now that sameness that we notice in things, between things, among things, it's not in things, sameness is only in the mind. Sameness between differences is not a tangible, measurable thing. It's a mental thing. So if we observe the way the behavior of one species, let's take a bat and a sparrow. If we notice the behaviors of bats and sparrows, and then we can add another one in there, squirrels, we can notice that they are animals. All three are animals. One is a four-legged earthbound animal. One is an animal that flies. And the other is an animal that flies but is not a mammal. The sparrow is not a mammal, the bat is a mammal, and the squirrel is a mammal. And so there are samenesses that we can observe in their nest building, their feeding patterns, their mobility patterns. The squirrel jumps through the trees and sometimes flies. The bat lives in caves and flies every day. And the bird flies all the time. And they all build nests. And
they all move.
So, yeah, they move. They're mobile. That's the first thing, according to Aristotle, mobility. They all have perception. We can look at the evolutionary criteria. They have growth and nutrition, that's a kind of mobility. They have perception, they see and hear and feel and all of that. And they have the ability to organize their environments for the sake of their survival. They learn about seasonal changes, they know when to build their nests, when to hibernate. So they have behavior patterns that have similarities. We know about those similarities, they don't. Those similarities don't exist outside of the mind. So mind, then, we can conclude, is a universal principle of existence. Like life and body. It is manifested in the species in an observable way with respect to the way they organize their lives. And some of them have elaborate communication systems even, and so on. But mind itself isn't manifested in any of those species. Mind itself is manifested in our species. In our species, it knows these patterns, it knows how they work, it recognizes them, it can use them, it can modify their behaviors scientifically, technologically. It designs its own habitats, not instinctively, but intellectually. But it designs similar habitats, it reproduces itself, it's mobile for the purpose of getting food. This life-mind-body complex of ours does everything that they do, including flying, but much more technologically and intellectually. So mind, because we do all the things that they do, but we do them intellectually, and we do them on a large communal scale, global. We don't just do them for ourselves, but we sell them to our neighbors for a profit. So we are engaged in a mental, the elaboration of a mental species life form. What's beyond it? If anything. Well, Sri Aurobindo suggested last time that because all of this is the way it is, and as we have seen through scientific points of view, cognition is present even in the cell. So this mind principle is ever present. The nervous system is producing cognition independent of us, and that's material stuff. We're not running that show. It's running our show. And so our bodies are providing this conscious base for us all the time. The citta is there, remembering everything, deciding everything. It sometimes pops into our minds as a logically good idea to do what it's telling us to do. So we reflect on what we're doing most of the time. We don't think ahead very much. So this cognition is obviously a potential of matter. So Sri Aurobindo goes to this point in that direction, and he says that if cognition or consciousness is a principle of matter, and if it is doing all of this in all of these, in this infinite variety of ways, and even in the least conscious, it's somehow able to anticipate and take steps beyond to what it can become, even when what it can become is not apparent even to us. If we look back through species, you know, what the shrew can become isn't apparent to us, but it did become the hippo and the primate. So if there is this inherent drive of life on the one hand, which it's a principle, the drive of life, and there is this mental mind-like intelligence, to use an inadequate expression, if there is this universal intelligence that's able to do all of these things that we mental beings still can't really understand. We still don't know how bats fly, I'm told. we don't really understand the dynamics of bat flight. Then he says there must be a greater intelligence working in things unconsciously that can evolve itself more fully. It can emerge in another species with its full, absolute, inherent power of knowing and doing in the universe. And we are just an indication of that possibility. But he says it's so far beyond us and what we are that we can't even imagine what it is. But he says it's there, it's inevitable that it's there, and it's inevitable that it emerges at some point as in a form. that some living beings have that degree of consciousness in them. So then the next question is, what is indicated with respect to the evolutionary transition that has to be taken between this mental species and that next supramental species? That's the other question. What is implied and what is indicated as an evolutionary process for human beings to go beyond mind? Sri Aurobindo is unique in the history of philosophy in that he not only saw the nature of existence philosophically and spiritually, but he recommended a procedure for evolving beyond mind. And he practiced it. So this is described in a couple of places that I would recommend that you read. I have another reading assignment for you. In addition to 6 and 7, in the synthesis of, in the last part of the synthesis of yoga, chapters 6 and 7, which are all about mind, there are two other chapters, 29 and 30. One is called The Nature of Supermind, and the next one is called The Intuitive Mind. Sri Aurobindo states very explicitly here what the nature of supermind is, and what the intermediate possibility of the human is. And the intermediate possibility of the human he calls the intuitive mind. So we're going to look at that tonight. I wanted to do that tonight before going on to the anthropic principle, because if we can understand a little bit what this intuitive mind is, how we can access it, then this anthropic principle will look very different to us than if we just hear about it rationally. I can tell you all about the anthropic principle from the rational scientific standpoint. But if we have the possibility of knowing things from within instead of assembling them from without, maybe we can know what this anthropic principle is all about from within. If we make an effort to not know about it rationally, but to really approach it intuitively. So in order to really approach it intuitively, we need to shift away from our logical, rational, perceptual mode of being humans, that thing which we're so good at and so bad at the same time, because it's such an imperfect way of being, and yet it's better than all the rest of them. Thank you. And think about the possibility of knowing the anthropic principle itself. When we get to it, first of all, let's try to know something about this transition from mind to supermind through the intuitive mind. There's no doubt that Sri Aurobindo has written these two chapters in order for us to contemplate exactly what the transition point is. There is no doubt about it. What it is, how it happens, and what are its limits, what are its potentials, what is its being, what is its nature, what is the intuitive mind, we are told explicitly. And then make a note of this. These are only a few paragraphs in these two chapters. But 20 years later, he wrote two new, huge chapters elaborating exactly this in The Light Divine, the ones that we did this summer, the Triple Transformation and the Ascent Towards Supermind. So everything that we're going to read here, he has expanded to their absolute fullness of understanding in those two chapters in The Life Divine, The Triple Transformation and The Ascent Towards Supermind. And there he has elaborated the process, evolutionary process. Detailed, step by step. So this here we find a few paragraphs. That will trigger the shift. The fundamental nature of this supermind, let's just read that definition again with which we ended last time. It is to this intelligence, infinite in itself, but freely organizing and self-determiningly organic in its self-creation. And it works that we may and self-creation and its works, that we may give for our present purpose the name of the divine supermind or gnosis. That intelligence, capital I, that logos, which is in everything, driving everything from within. It's not out there somewhere. It's in here. It is in this. It's nowhere else. It's not something to be discovered or whatever. It's not some heavenly being. It's the innermost nature of everything. The fundamental nature of this supermind is that all its knowledge is originally a knowledge by identity and oneness. And even when it makes numberless apparent divisions and discriminating modifications in itself, still all the knowledge that operates in its workings, even in these divisions, is founded upon and sustained and lit and guided by this perfect knowledge by identity and oneness. The Spirit is one everywhere, and it knows all things as itself. Spirit in us and in everything doesn't know what it knows as something other than itself which it observes and understands, it knows, its kind of knowing, is from within because it is that. This is knowledge by identity, to know what you are, not objectively, but subjectively. It is you. The idea is that this supramental gnosis, which is not knowing the one in the sense that we think of knowing, is knowledge and energy of expression of the self in forms, which doesn't cease to be the self when it's in forms. It continues to be the self of everything. So, sees them, all things, always, and therefore knows them intimately, completely, in their reality, as well as their appearance, in their truth, their law, the entire spirit and sense and figure of their nature and their workings. When it sees anything as an object of knowledge, it yet sees it as itself and in itself, and not as a thing other than or divided from it, about which, therefore, it would at first be ignorant of the nature, constitution, and workings, and have to learn about them, as the mind is at first ignorant of its object and has to learn about it, because the mind is separated from its object and regards and senses and meets it as something other than itself and external to its own being. The mental awareness we have of our own subjective existence and its movements, our I, though it may point to, is not the same thing as this identity and self-knowledge, because what it sees are mental figures of our being. Our own mind sees mental figures of our being and not the inmost or the whole, and it is only a partial, derivative, and superficial action of ourself that appears to us, while the largest and most secretly determining parts of our own existence are occult to our mentality. We don't know all of those things that the citta holds in it that determine our actions when we get angry, because something triggers a whole long line of unconscious associations in us. We're not aware of how all that happens. We just know that suddenly we feel offended. And that's what we call ourself. But supermind, he says, is much more than that kind of knowing. It knows the whole history, depth, and place in our evolution of that behavior. Why that behavior is what it is at that time in relation to what we have to become through our own evolution. The whole being, not just the momentary temporal expression. And it knows it not objectively, but it is it. It is that movement of the citta. And it's also the movement of all the other citta and their combination when they meet together in the assembly tomorrow and make a decision. And why that decision is what it is, even though it's wrong. This is a powerful idea of a possibility of knowledge which is absolute and impersonal. It's not making judgments about the way things are. It is the way things are. It can only go where it goes, for the reasons that it goes there. And those are far beyond any measurable, spatial, temporal expression. Because the purpose of the evolution of this consciousness is consciousness itself. It's not the structures. It's not the momentary formations. It's its own infinitude of potentiality, which is its essence. And that infinitude of potentiality cannot be manifested. So if one is perceiving that, and perceiving each thing temporally in relation to that infinite potential, then personal interest and judgment dissolves completely. One is merely identified with and energized by and loving of what is. To skip to the next paragraph, this is the second character of the supreme supermind, that its knowledge is a real, because a total knowledge. The implication of that statement is that what is not total is not real. It's illusory. It has in the first place a transcendental vision and sees the universe not only in the universal terms but in its right relation to the supreme and eternal reality. Everything that is in relationship to the absolute. But we don't see that. We think that the absolute, like Spencer said in the beginning of evolution, the absolute can't be known by the human being. We just know that it must be there. And because it's there, force circulates through matter and creates form and sustains form, and there's the dissipation of energy ad infinitum because the absolute is there. Otherwise it couldn't be what it is. But we don't know what that is. Sri Aurobindo turns that idea completely upside down and says, not only is it there, but we can know it completely because it's here. So there's this long interlude in philosophy where knowledge is thought of as some kind of abstract construction of the human mind. Yeah, it's an ontological argument. The idea that knowledge is a construction of the human mind is an epistemological argument. The idea that what is known is what is by identity is an ontological argument. Very clever observation. This is the big shift in philosophy which took place in the 20th century. Thanks to phenomenology, we became more interested in ontology than in epistemology. The more intuitive and inspired philosophers gave up the question of how do we know what is and asked the question, what is? Period. More interesting than how do we know it? Because we don't know how we know it. We can't know how we know it. Because how we know it is by a faculty called intuition, which is not conscious in us. So we're going to come to that point. It knows the spirit and truth and whole sense of the universal expression because it knows all the essentiality and all the infinite reality and all the consequent, constant potentiality of that which, in part, it expresses. So, for example, it expresses the will to the realization of a harmonious and efficient human unity through tomorrow night's assembly. That is a partial expression of an infinite potentiality. It knows both the infinite potentiality and the partial expression. And so it can put its full knowledge into the partial expression and not be bothered by the fact that it goes completely haywire along the way. It may have a better possibility of becoming something more lasting, but even then, we're only human beings at the beginning of a possibility which has eons ahead of it, and our failures, as he says again and again, are our successes. So don't worry about it. But be it. It knows rightly the relative. Okay, what we experience from moment to moment is the relative. And tomorrow night's meeting we will know relative to 2 years ago when we approved that Lavanir with all this nonsense that it took to do that. And then had that approval blocked for a whole year by the stupid working committee. And so now we have another stupid working committee that's trying to undo what that working committee finally decided to do a year late. And this is the partial relative nature. It knows rightly the relative because it knows the absolute and all its absolutes to which the relatives refer back, and of which they are the partial or modified or suppressed figures.
Would we say that as it goes to the collective level, it automatically becomes relative?
It automatically becomes relative as soon as it exists. At any level. If you don't understand what I mean. Nothing exists which is not relative in time and space. The absolute is not relative. It's absolute. But it is knowable outside of time and space. Okay, in the second place, it, the divine supermind, which is as absolute as mind gets, because it knows the absolute intimately, and it knows the relative intimately, and it stands between the two hemispheres. The divine supermind is a universal emanation of the Supreme, sometimes known as the Mahashakti. It is, in the second place, universal in everything, vibrant in the atom, in the life force, in the self-reflection and in the will of everything. In normal philosophical terms, it's omnipresent. It is universal and sees all that is individual in the terms of the universal. So let's think about a universal for a minute. Has anybody got a favorite universal that came to you as a result of my request that you start thinking about universals and living your day in terms of universals instead of particulars? Did anybody latch on to one that you particularly like?
Music is universal.
So you can see your broken down scooter in terms of music? You can see everything in terms of music all the time? You can hear the harmony and the pitch and the rhythm in everything, and that's how you depersonalize your experience all day, every day? Energy? Except the things which are not moving. Okay, movement is not universal because some things don't move.
Only if breathing things not move.
Okay, well, that's something.
Progress.
Okay, change. The most meaningless universal, change. Death. Life, change, energy transformations.
Energy.
Paradise.
Yes, energy, nature, consciousness.
Energy that we don't even know or realize anything about.
Okay, you could see everything as a process of cognition. So everything is constantly changing energy, but also learning at the same time. You could perceive that also. And then that would be a kind of universal energy plus meaning. We talked about the spirit of healing. Okay, but then vastness is just nothing. It's vast. But what is in everything? If you look at yourself, your neighbor, your chair, your building here, and your road home, and your routine that you go through while you're at home, and what you're doing right now, participating in this process, is there some principle that you can be aware of in all of those moments? Space and time. Change. Existence. Spaciousness means existence. Right?
Yes.
Everything exists. How about emptiness? Is space empty or is it full? The Buddhists say that you can see emptiness in everything and that that is the reality of everything, and wisdom means seeing everything as emptiness, as space. They also say that you can see everything as compassion, that there's a spirit of compassion that brings everything into existence and takes everything out of existence, and that is all forgiving and all loving and all liberating, and that the universal nature of existence is compassion. I like learning. I like the idea that everything is participating in a process of exchange of information that helps it survive, or that helps it realize itself, or that gives it joy. There's a pressure in things to be conscious, to be more conscious, to act more consciously.
How does energy fit into that?
Well, energy exchange carries with it information. You can't imagine any exchange of energy, I don't think, that doesn't convey some information about time and space, location, luminosity, quantity, quality. I mean, every color is energy, every sound is energy, and that sound has an origin and has an end, and its origin and end convey themselves through the sound as what they are. So being, for example. Yes, that's universal. Universality, there you go. If you can psychologically elevate your perception to that level, you can perceive everything as an expression of joy. Every particle of energy is a particle of joy. And so Euripides could say that love is the essential force in existence. Was it? No, it was Empedocles. So, love is the essential force of existence, like compassion. So, absolutes, power, divine love, divine truth, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, and Maheshwari, these are universal forces. You can perceive everything as universal divine power, as universal divine truth. Only the truth could exist, because truth is everything if you see it as the universal divine. Sacrifice. Everything is a sacrifice. Agni. All energy transformations are sacrifices. One bit of energy serves the being of another through its own dissipation. Existence is a universal sacrifice. The universe is burning its energy all the time. The human being is burning its energy all the time. Nature is burning its energy all the time for the maintenance of all the qualities and processes and functions that we are aware of. Universal sacrifice. Beauty, goodness,
bliss,
death,
bliss,
bliss. Okay, so he's telling us to look at the absolute and its absolutes and their temporal expressions as one multidimensional self-being. So even in the most relative, imperfect expression of sacrifice, kill that mosquito. To the most divine self-giving for the sake of another that you can imagine. Christ, for example. there are many, many different intentions. So each of the intentions, the supreme sacrifice has the intention of bringing out of nothingness the divine. So the supreme sacrifice is the entry of the absolute divine into the absolute nihil for the purpose of the evolution back through the eons, through suffering, through sacrifice that repeats that first sacrifice to the ultimate divine sacrifice of bowing at the feet of the divine herself in a state of complete immolation. Self-immolation in bliss is a sacrifice which is received by the divine who recognizes the total self-giving of the soul. So that's a spiritual aspect of the possibility of knowing things universally. But there are innumerable universals. Life is the simplest, most straightforward one that we perceive in ourselves and others and nature and the biosphere and the interchange of oxygen and water, and we're swimming in a sea of life energy all the time. Universal life, universal matter, universal mind. These are, so this guy, the supermind, holds all these individual figures in their right and complete relation to the universe. It is in the third place, separately, with regard to individual things, total in its view, because it knows each in its inmost essence, of which all else is the resultant. So the inmost essence of something is its goodness, its will to be, and from that all else results. So however it acts, whatever it is, whatever it does, is a resultant of that inmost essence, even if it's completely perverted, even if it's obviously self-interested, but serving others. Even if it's human, its essential nature is that divine will to be. And if you perceive that in it, then those shortcomings, those relativities of expression, are understood for what they are in relation to what is potential. And in the act of perceiving that, it's not just perceiving, it is the energy of that being itself which is being known in its own potential and its own relative imperfection at the same time, because it is what is, it's not other. But what is much more complex than what we normally think it is. There are many levels and dimensions of what is, which the mind can't know. But the good news is that intuition is an expression of that supramental gnosis. And it is possible for mind, the rational, which is an expression of the intuition. You know, when we think we know something and why and so on, that's a rational expression of the intuition. it's possible to move back into the intuition itself of the universal nature, the essential nature, the luminous self-being of things, even though it's not the luminous self-being of everything, which is what the supermind is. But it is a possible, temporal, here and now, personal perception of the essential nature and energy of the things that are here now. And it's not rational. It comes from within because those things are in us. It's a mistake for us to think that we are outside of each other. We are inside each other. And all of us is knowable by each other as ourself. LSD shows you that. But it's possible by a spiritual evolution to live like that. And Sri Aurobindo says that is the key. That's the lever between mind and supermind. And only if we can make that step is the next step possible.
You say that we calculate found the friend zone rings by intuition, which was never thought about before in chemistry. We got a glimpse of this intuition, of this supramental level.
Say it again.
Kekule was a chemist, and he found out by intuition that the benzo is not like all other things in chemistry, be in line, but it is in a ring. And he saw this intuitively in a dream, I think.
Okay,
and
I
brought it to paper, then he found out that it was a deep truth in the reality.
Right. I don't think so. If it were done consciously, and Sri Aurobindo says that the intuitive mind is not only seeing, but it is also the energy of the thing which is seen itself. And so it's a kind of seeing being, energizing all at the same time. It's not just a mental image that comes to us occultly and enables us to understand something. That is a breaking into the mind of an intuition. And he says all poetry is written like that. The mind thinks it's writing it, but actually it's coming from the intuitive plane. But being, this is in the chapter called The Ascent Towards Supermind. There's a long section on intuitive mind. And it is extraordinary. It's unbelievable what he envisioned to be the principle and reality of the intuitive mind is itself unimaginable. But, he says, it's within human reach. And I want to get to this last part of the chapter here so that you'll know that it's here. The supermind in the lower nature is present most strongly as intuition. And it is therefore by a development of an intuitive mind that we can make the first step towards the self-existent, spontaneous, and direct supramental knowledge. That supermind is present in us most accessibly, most strongly as intuition, but not what we think of as intuition. So let's be very clear about that. Forget what you think intuition is. It's not that. But it is a power of consciousness that we can evolve in this mental life. And Sri Aurobindo has done it, and he has described every minute of it. So you can find out what it is. All the physical, vital, emotional, psychic, dynamic nature of man is a surface seizing of suggestions which rise out of a subliminal, intuitive self-being of these parts. An intuitive self-being of the life and body and mind and psychic and spiritual experiences that we have in this being have another level of themselves, which is the intuitive mind force being level that we don't see. And it contains in it knowledge and power of the whole potential of these things which we now know intuitively, which is to say luminously and transparently. And an attempt, this is ours, usually groping and often circuitous, to work them out in the action of a superficial embodiment and power of the nature which is not overtly enlightened by the inner power and knowledge. An increasingly intuitive mind has the best chance of discovering what they, the ordinary mind, mental mind, life mind, body mind, what they are seeking for, and leading them to the desired perfection of their self-expression. The intuitive mind can lead the mind and the life and the body to their fulfillment. And its workings are different than the mind's. For one thing, it is. It doesn't think. It is what it sees, and it sees what it is. And so the effort to perceive and analyze and understand and figure out, all of that doesn't work. It's necessary to accept that there is a greater power than mind, which can do what mind does better than mind, which can do what life does better than life, which can be more physically what the body is than the body is, and to allow it to enter, descend, illumine, refocus the being. And he says this is not the supermind, and it doesn't mean a supramental transformation, but it is the lever. And until we do that, we can't have any possibility of manifesting the supermind itself, because that intuitive mind is the channel through which its origin, which is the supreme divine energy of being that our bodies would simply explode with if it came close, has to build an instrument. And in the first part of the next chapter, I'm not going to find it there, I'm just going to read it to you. In the first place, this process of opening to that truer, transparent vision force, the emergence, must be a gradual and at first an imperfect creation. And to his customary mind, the activity of an exceptional and supernormal will and knowledge. In the first place, it will not be for him, the evolutionary being, a native power always enjoyed without interruption, but a secret potentiality which has to be discovered. And one for which there are no organs in his present physical or mental system. In the first place, it will not be for him a native power always enjoyed without interruption, but a secret potentiality which has to be discovered, and one for which there are no organs in his present physical or mental system.
So they will develop through evolution.
He has either to evolve a new organ for it, or else to adapt or transform existing ones and make them utilizable for the purpose. The problem of this conversion resolves itself at first into a passage through a mediary status, and by the help of the one power already at work in the human mind, which we can recognize as something supramental in its nature, or at least in its origin, the faculty of intuition, a power of which we can feel the presence and the workings, and are impressed when it acts by its superior efficiency, light, direct inspiration, and force, but cannot understand or analyze it as we understand or analyze the workings of our reason. It simply is a power of seeing, knowing, being, energizing from within the without.
Very specific process.
it's a few pages after that one. It's at the beginning of the intuitive mind. Second page. These two chapters, the nature of the supermind and the intuitive mind, and those two chapters in the Life Divine, Triple Transformation and Ascent Towards Supermind, fully explain the consciousness itself and how it works, which is intermediate between the rational mind and supermind. Feel the presence of it. This pressure that one feels in this field of yoga shakti, where we live, This is what the mother was manifesting. This is that luminous energy that she was manifesting, that she is still manifesting. Our question is how to allow it to replace those functions that we're so attached to. This is not an idea. This is a force of consciousness, chit shakti. And it's really up to us to find a way to admit it. It's always there. The question is, how do we integrate it with our intention and make it the purpose, the evolutionary purpose of life, instead of all of the other things which we think are so important? To recognize the potential of something else, we tend to make everything else more important. Says several times in these chapters that the silence of the mind, the absolute silence of the mind, and the absolute equality of nature, samatha, are necessary for Shakti to become the ruler of life. So they're the traditional yogic concepts to facilitate that process. Samatha, Shakti. Of being intuitively conscious. It's another energy than the ordinary ones that we have evolved.